So yeah, we started the firm in 2020, and then at the beginning, obviously, servicing like CFO services and in Spain. But pretty quickly, it started growing, partially thanks to VCs that started recommending us. And by now, we are 38 people. We are mostly based in Madrid, but we also have a small office in Berlin, in Germany, because we started having the clients there.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without having to buy an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Jaime Medina, the startup CFO, TSCFO.com, from Spain, directly talking to us today. And we're going to get into some funding sources for your B2B SaaS that you may not have considered. So Jaime has had some creative approaches to raising money for something I always thought you had to go to a VC for, or maybe private equity, but he's got some other ideas and a great case study. Jaime, you're welcome to the show. Maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, James, for inviting me. I mean, what I always say, only half jokingly, is that I think I'm better at singing than at finance. Like, I think I'm better and I like it more. So I have no idea why I ended up in this career, but I love singing. I love karaoke. I find any excuse. I took lessons, in fact, for many years. And if I could, that's what I would dedicate my whole time to.
What's your favorite song to sing for? Are you a karaoke guy, or do you like a proper crowd, or what's your favorite song to sing for you?
Well, I think mostly like lower stuff, but I would say in English, certainly Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash. It's always a pretty big success.
Okay. All right, listeners, I want you to stay to the very end of the podcast where I'm going to make Jaime give me sing Ring of Fire for us. So that's it. That's one reason to stay to the end, if nothing else. All right. Perfect. So the singing CFO, I love it. I've already got my title for my YouTube. It alliterates, so it must be true. But let's make sure you got the credentials here, the backup, not just the jazz hands, but the financial sweat earned. So tell us a bit about your background and your career highlights so far.
Perfect. So, well, in college, I studied physics, so far from where I am now. But then, I started a PhD in New York, and then I joined McKinsey, the consulting firm, for a couple of years. And that's where I switched to business, essentially. And then after a couple of years, I got a really good, interesting opportunity in a Spanish startup founded by an experienced founder that had already had a great exit. So I decided to jump in, and this was 2017. And since then, I haven't left the startup world in the finance area. So I worked in a couple startups full-time as CFO. And then soon I started seeing that many startups that are in early stage need help in the finance area. But to be honest, they don't need an experienced guy full-time in the team until they are big enough. So in 2018, I started freelancing. In 2020, I established the company, the startup CFO already.
Can I ask you about your McKinsey experience? So it's a brand name. It's on your CV. Yeah. That's basically going to make you for life, right? Was that your intention going into it? Listen, I know they grind people out. Just do a couple of years and then move on. What happened there?
More or less, it's in my case, coming from science, I had like zero idea about the non-science world and about the business world and about the corporate world or anything like that. So I knew several people that had told me like, well, if you don't know anything about the business world, you are good with people, you are good with numbers and stuff. This is a pretty good way to create a brand for yourself and also to see many other sectors. But I had no clue if it was going to be a temporary thing or a long-term thing. I mean, pretty sure after joining, I realized it was going to be a temporary thing. But because it's very draining. But to me, it was like the perfect experience in the perfect moment of my career, I think.
Okay. So, and also there are hardly any jobs for physicists, right? Like it's a hard place to get a job.
Yeah. So you can see they trust people with weird backgrounds, and that helped me indeed.
What do you think having a physics background, if any, gives you an edge in your CFO work?
Well, certainly, I think this is like a general advice I would give to anyone. Like, I think you need to be a bit unique or like to find, like to have a different profile than anyone else. It's like, if you just study the same thing than another million people, and then you went to the same place than a million other people, then I'm not sure why they would choose you among 1 million people. So I think, like, in general, like, having a weird background is true. I think it makes you think differently. In my case, is the analytical part is like built in 5 years of college that it was in Spain at the time. Like, it really builds in an analytical framework that is absolutely incredible. And I think what I got from McKinsey was more, not only the financial knowledge, in fact, or the business knowledge, but a lot on the soft skills and on the people skills that certainly physicists are not very well trained for in general.
You sound very rounded, like a scientist background, and then you've got the soft skills, the total package. You can even sing people to sleep. It sounds good so far. Okay, now, before we move on from this, just tell us a little bit about the firm you've built, the size, number of people you have, where you're located, and just we'll cover that off.
Perfect. So yeah, we started the firm in 2020, and then at the beginning, obviously, servicing like CFO services and in Spain. But pretty quickly, it started growing, partially thanks to the VC that we will talk later to VCs that started recommending us. And by now, we are 38 people. We are mostly based in Madrid, but we also have a small office in Berlin, in Germany, because we started having clients there. I mean, in fact, we have had clients internationally, and we have clients like in many places. But the core markets for us are Spain and Germany. And we are now offering many more services, all related to startup finance. But also we offer public funding, bank funding services, or even private funding. We also do training for corporates. We also do due diligence for investors. We even have an academy program for like general public, like a B2C course on startup finance. So we have diversified a lot, I think, in business lines, grew the team, and grew internationally. And we hope that this continues to be this way in the future.
Okay. So what was really interesting to me is that you have a story about how you found an alternate funding source. I think for B2B SaaS, you know, it's got to be pitch decks. Normally, CFO work for SaaS is pitch decks. It's cash flow projections. It's like kind of wavy hand stuff, you know. But tell us a bit about the story that you had a client. I guess they were on that path. Tell us where, what stage they had got to by the time they had met you, and what sort of options they were looking at for funding and what you did for them.
Perfect. So, well, I mean, first of all, a bit of intro, I would say, in a general topic besides this particular case. Like, we have worked already with over 350 early stage startups. And I would say B2B SaaS are probably like between half or two thirds of the companies. So this is something that I'll give you a specific example of one of the companies I worked full time. But I think we can like make some like claims about like how it works in early stage, not just for that particular company. So obviously VC money is always key in funding a startup. And usually what you are talking is like funding on top of that, you know, but of course the funding that is on top of that is non-dilutive funding. So if you can minimize the VC you need and then complement it with non-dilutive funding, that's the best setup. So this company in particular, when they had just raised 3.6 million a year around, I would say seven months before I joined, I think 3.6 million euros. And the company was already having revenues, I would say near 2 million ARR. I would say, well, no, even less when I joined. I think, yeah, like 1.5 million ARR. So when I joined, the runway of the company was 11 months. Like, we expected to run out of cash in 11 months, and we needed them to raise funding in 5-6 months from like when I joined. But then like my claim was, okay, maybe the company is not growing like so good that we can guarantee a wonderful Series B round. So let's try to find any other funding that can help us extend the runway. So when we raise the next round, we are in better conditions. So in this case, what I did, well, first of all, we maximized public funding. This depends a lot on the country. Like in Spain or in Europe in general, I would say there's a lot of public funding for startups. And this is like a competitive advantage that, if you don't take, someone else is going to take it. So in general, they are good conditions and it's certainly worth it. I always tell companies like they should have some consultants that are up to date, and every 6 months ask them, is there anything that is for us right now? Because usually they are super complicated. They like, even to know if you meet the requirements is not easy. So certainly a lot of bureaucracy there. So first of all, we maximized that. We got a grant of 250,000 euros. We got a soft loan of 1 million euros, but that was like a bit. But something that was very surprising to the CEO was when I told him that I was pretty convinced that banks could give us money. And this is like another misconception.
Well, just before, sorry to interrupt you, Jaime, but I'm interested here. Let's double click on the funding because, you know, I'm in Ireland here and there's a European framework which kind of restricts how governments can help their startup ecosystem. That's what we're always talking about here. The Irish government is always saying, oh, we'd love to do more, but Europe restricts us, et cetera, et cetera. And in Ireland, it's pretty much, you know, there's incubator programs and then there's 50-50 matched funding from the government for most things. What's Spain's approach? How do they do it?
There is, by the way, on this topic, I can't help recommending a book called Boulevard of Broken Dreams, like the song, in fact. But it's about the efforts of public money into the entrepreneurship world. It's a bit geeky, but I recommend that book always. So in Spain, many of the VCs have the government as an LP, meaning like the government is investing money in that VC fund as if it was any other private investor. But of course, then if you just manage to raise 60 million, for example, with private investors, then the government can complement with another 30. So again, something I like of that initiative in particular is that then the VC still is not incentivized to pick anything different just because they have the government on their side. So they will try to make the best business investments out of it. That's part of the story and not known to many people because it's within the VC, not accessible to the startup directly. But then to startups directly, I would say there are mostly three sources that are relevant in the country. One of them is soft loans. If you got, let's say, 2 million, well, usually with less money, 700,000 RAM, the government can give you a soft loan of up to 700,000. So this 50-50 approach that you were mentioning. And you don't need to put any collateral or any, like, something like, to keep
when
it
you nice. Say When you say soft loan, does that mean a loan you never really have to pay back? Or what is a soft loan?
You do, but within maybe 10 years. And with a deferral period of 3 years at the beginning and without any collateral. Hold on, I'm going to speak about bank financing, but that doesn't mean that it's like at any time. And because usually if it's too soon, the banks will ask for a collateral. It's like, okay, but if you don't pay me back, I'll keep your home. You know, which by the way, it does make sense in very early stages. But the government in these type of loans, it does not doesn't require any collateral of any kind. So that one is very typical. Then there are also grants, like pure grants, that you don't need to pay back. And this is usually for very technological companies. Like the threshold is higher if they are funding R&D rather than innovation, for example. So better conditions, but to fewer number of companies. And this can be pure grant. And then the third one is tax incentives, which is especially relevant when the company is bigger, because otherwise, like we're talking about almost zero taxes, or they are not paying them, or they cannot claim any R&D tax back or whatever. But so not to kickstart, but when the company has some size, it's certainly something that also helps.
So this all sounds great. So here's a question. The government's basically matching your money. The VCs are getting an extra 50% on their capital to help the thing succeed. Not to them, but, you know, it goes into the same project. So it's a boost, right? As far as I'm aware, they don't get that in the US. So what, you know, but yet there's this thing, why is Europe lagging when it comes to unicorns, innovation? We seem to have an unfair advantage over our Yankee friends, and we seem to have extra money. What's going on?
You need to send me your address and I'll send you a copy of the book. I mentioned One of Our Broken Dreams. I think this is a topic that we can debate for 5 hours, but they say that in fact, part of the effect may be the crowding out effect. So in Europe, maybe they're like, the return on venture capital is like, like any other asset, is absolutely correlated to the amount of money in that asset.
Right.
So like if you invest next year in Europe, one way or another, twice the funding, then the returns are going to be very poor. So what they say is that there's a crowding out effect of like the public funding took over the private one, and then the public funding creates less private interests, you know, like, okay, this company, for example, I know companies that have got European funding that is very hard to get, and they have got 2.5 million euro pure grant to get started. And in my opinion, it was wasted money because they're like, it's not the same that if there is a VC firm that has already worked with a ton of companies like that, that is guiding it through business decisions. You know, it's not the same like the company has 2.5 million, let's play with it to build our toy. So too much public funding can kick out experts that could be delivering it. And if there wasn't that much, maybe there would be higher returns that would attract experts. But I mean, this is a complicated topic, of course. Probably I wouldn't be able to solve it in a while.
We can solve it here, and we can just email the government and let them know, you know, and then they can get on to whatever, building schools or whatever they're supposed to be doing. So, okay, cool. So let's get back to the story then. You know, first of all, from what you're telling me so far, it's highlighting really how a fractional CFO can kind of pay for themselves in a lot of situations. So, you know, I'm a programmer. I know there are grants out there. I'm just not my thing. But when you're plugged into these things, the supports there bury in paperwork sometimes. And it's actually not that hard, but it's supposed to put you off in a way. It's no big deal if you're someone who give it to someone who does it all day in, day out. And that's maybe a first reason if you're at that early stage. Maybe you think you're too early for a fractional CFO, but hey, maybe a fractional CFO can pay for themselves largely because they're just going to do work that, let's face it, you're not going to do. And so, okay, but let's get on to this story. So you've done all the basics, you got them the government money. Then they are looking for other sources here. They've already raised 3.6, thinking about raising more. What? And you brought up this idea of bank financing.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, I think like we should talk to banks. And here's also a difference that may depend on the bank, but also on the CFO that presents the information. So some banks are more prone to, or I think it's a marketing strategy, to be honest, to like they market themselves as a bank for startups. You know, they may be a traditional bank, but for example, they may have branches that have a different name or like a digital mindset, you know, for startups and entrepreneurs. Of course, they know that in the short term, maybe a startup will not give them much, but they know that if that startup becomes a huge thing, you want to be the bank that started working with them, of course. In fact, that's part of the strategy, but later on when talking to banks, they told me that they have more default rate in SMEs than in startups. And I remember asking the bank, and they told me, like, if you walk in your street this year and in 5 years, how many stores are the same? You know, or restaurants or stuff like that, you know, in the middle of Madrid. Meaning that, like, traditional businesses that are, like, startups are super risky. Yes, but, like, aren't traditional business super risky? I mean, depending on which one, of course. But there are so many restaurants that close every year, like at least in Madrid, like you walk around and like you see different ones every month. So the default rate is in fact lower. For many of the banks already, they are making money with startups. It's a good marketing for them. And if they hit it, if they hit the right one early on, they will be an amazing client for many years. So it's better, obviously, if you try to approach some of these banks that have specialized branches and special marketing for startups, because they will be more prone to give you offers. In Spain at the time, out of the four biggest banks, there were two especially that had that marketing and had luckily, I would say, the bank had always had its operations with another bank, with a third bank. So with the bank that already existed, it was relatively easier because we already had operations there. So by the way, my first advice to be to have operations since the beginning with several banks. It doesn't need to be huge, but like maybe you pay the payroll from this bank, maybe you pay taxes from this one, and maybe you pay providers from this other, something like that. But if you have operations with a bank, it's more likely that they know you already, you have already given them some commissions in the past, they can trust you because they have seen their cash flows, maybe they have your financials since 3 years ago. That certainly helps. So with the banks that were, like, I'm talking traditional banks here. I'm not talking Revolut or Konto or things like that, but like purely traditional banks. The ones that are more startup-y, usually their sales department is dedicated to startups. Usually they still come from the SMEs, so it takes a while for them to adapt completely. But the risk department is centralized. This is usually the case. Of course, it may depend on the bank, but the risk department analyzes both startups and SMEs, but the sales guy that talks to the client is specialized in startups. So the work you need to do is not with the salesman. The salesman is on your side. The salesman wants his commission. You need to help him convince the other guy.
Sure.
Then the risks guy. If possible, try to meet the risks guy yourself or invite them to the office. In general, If startups are in an office, by the way, which I'm talking before COVID, and now many of our clients don't even have an office. But like, if it has an office, usually it's pretty fancy and modern, deliberately, out of culture. So this factor plays a role. Bring the risks guy to the office, you know, and make him see that there's something here. That guy probably has the stereotype in his brain that like a startup is 2 18-year-olds in a garage. You bring him and he sees 40 people working in a nice office and things change. I'm supposed to be the technical guy, and I work so much on the human side. Like, in the end, it's about convincing someone, and that is about emotions. Anyway, I'll get to the technical part. So in the technical part, and the arguments you need to convince that guy is on the unit economics there. So what they are used, like many banks, their very first question they ask is like, does the founder have kids? Because like, you know, generation, I think, and to me, it's like, come on, the guy's 25. You know, he's not talking about his future kids running the company. Or second question, do they own the office? And you're like, of course not. This is a startup that is in a different co-working every 3 months, you know, something like that.
Right.
So you need to convince that guy that we are talking about something different. And to me, it's the concept that I try to get across always is the unit economics, is that we get a client for 100 euros, and that client gives us in time 600 euros, and I recover it within 4 months. So you are effectively giving me a loan that in 4 months I will have gotten back. Or, of course, I mean, I believe this argument, of course, you can keep scratching and finding more stuff, like how big is your market, or how can you achieve it, or like how is your sales team structured. But you can, like, I try to reduce it always to some type of unit economics. Also, in Uber, I mean, this is an exaggeration, but like for a business that we all would know, Uber needs some money to open a city that it would, like, it will not be profitable for a while, and then it will be profitable. And Uber deliberately uses that, like, gets funding rounds to open many cities at the same time. And when these cities start to be profitable, they are going to start opening more. So you can be unprofitable in a completely controlled and healthy way, or you can be unprofitable because you're wasting money. And the goal here is to say, like, this is deliberate. This does make sense. We can be profitable at any time. And by the way, in a SaaS business that already has like 2-3 million in revenue, if it's truly recurrent, you can also cut. If needed, you could also cut the development team in half and the salesman in half, and you'd have gone bankrupt. We do not see, like, we have not seen startups that have gone completely bankrupt that they have been funded by like over a couple of million. Because many times they do a horrible sale, but that's not the same for a bank. Like, if they sell horribly for 1 euro, the bank still gets the money back. So this is like a concept that obviously, like, you need to have that conversation with the risks guy and convince him with the numbers and with the history.
So first question that I always think of my business partner, anytime we talk about debt, he says, I'm not signing a personal guarantee. So do you need to sign a personal guarantee for this money?
I would never do it. Now, for me, like, for that is like a red line from the start. And we tell the CEOs, I think 99% of the times we have convinced them like not to do that. But yeah, like, to me, it's a red line that we say the bank on minute one. Like, I understand, by the way, this is not for any stage. I said the million to million revenue with the funding, with the true recurrent revenue. So I'm not saying like on day one, you have an idea, you go to the bank and they give it to you. No, there's no way. Right. And I do understand that the bank says, I'm not going to give you a million now. So maybe I can get 5% interest if it goes well. But if it goes bad, I lose the whole million. You know, like, I understand that completely.
So what's interesting here is, I mean, I understand what I heard there was, you know, banks are familiar with funding working capital, yeah, because they can understand that, creating a float, et cetera. With startups, it's often about funding growth, right? So it's something new that's going to a new sales team or, and what I'm hearing here is that they're getting a lot more into the business than I expected, because I would expect that you just send them a P&L on the balance sheet and they have a formula and it gives you the answer.
Yes, but they do have that. But the qualitative part is bigger than, I mean, usually like with the marketing part already, they want to relax it a bit. Like in the end, there's a score, but there's also a guy there. Mm-hmm. And they usually want to relax it a bit with startups. They do, like, good banks accept qualitative information here. Very good banks would, for example, distinguish like who is investing in the company. It's not the same one VC over another, for example. And for example, now I know several banks in Spain that are using fintech scoring to analyze their businesses. For example, CapChase in Spain, they serve worldwide, but CapChase is a wonderful company that funds only B2B SaaS business, and that is truly recurring. And what they analyze is your unit economics. So they are so successful and they have less default than banks that many banks now are buying their credit score, the credit scoring system. Because it's true that a SaaS business is a relatively new business compared to traditional businesses. And that's why the banks, I think, haven't still caught up. But the good ones are using the tools of new guys that analyze only SaaS businesses to use it as part of their credit score as well.
Okay. So CapChase, non-dilutive debt financing for your B2B SaaS. There's a couple of others out there. Name escapes me right now, but this is a European one, obviously.
Yeah.
So can you get like a credit score type from them to then bring to a bank or give you an idea, even if your business is fundable? Like, can I just go and get a score and figure out whether this is something I should chase?
That's a good question. I don't think so, but I know banks that have the agreement with them. So like they use them as an API, like I put the information here. I do. But also I do many trainings with banks, like with these startup branches of big banks. In fact, they are very good clients of us, and I do courses to them. And they are always concerned with, can I trust this information? You know, like it's not the same audited accounts versus you give me an Excel file that talks about your unit economics. But to me, it's like, well, first of all, you give a lot of money to unaudited companies, and that is true. Like I've seen it, I've done it myself. And second, that there is a way to prove the coherence between the numbers. Like, to be honest, I cannot make a random Excel file and simultaneously give you my last taxes that show, you know, my last corporate tax return, and I can make sense of them, you know, and it's not that hard. So on that, it's like where we try to dig deep, but like this requires conversation. Like if you just try to send the numbers they tell you and trust their score, it's going to be harder than if you go and say, listen, sit down here and I'm going to prove it to you.
Okay. Again, I'm going to make that physics brain work now. Are you ready for it? Let's see if you've really got this capacity for it.
I've forgotten everything.
let's see. It's actually not really physics, just math. But anyway, so let's say if you had to estimate going and finding this non-dilutive financing, how much money it has saved the founder personally in their own debt equity in the business. Like, what sort of estimate would you put on that? Like, you raised, how much was it? How much would it have cost them in dilution?
I would say between 10 and 20% of the last funding round, certainly I would say you can get. It depends on several things. For example, maybe if part of it is a credit line, you can get more because that's like 1 year and very controlled for the bank. Or something that I also advise to everyone is to run many processes in parallel. So maybe this bank gives you only 7% of your last funding round. This one gives you 10, this one gives you 8, this one gives you 5, and you add up to a 30 here. So
So let's do the math on that. So 10% of the last funding round, which was at what valuation?
Valuation, probably like 12 million, for example. Yeah. Maybe a bit more, 15.
So arguably, let's say you've saved a founder personally, because I'm a founder, and that's really... Let's be honest. That's where WIFM, what's in it for me, is like arguably maybe $1 million personally for that founder. Working with a fractional CFO saved that guy over just doing what everyone else is going to do and re-upping with the VC.
Exactly. Like many people think about us and about being CFO, like the guy that runs the finance department, the guy that runs the numbers, the guy that makes sure that the accounting is well done, that the invoices are sent, that our intercompany operations are well set and in relation to investors. But I always say that the F stands for finance. Like we need to finance this project. We need to put here $1 million so we get 10 million afterwards. And like on that way, obviously you need different types of funding depending on the sources that are available, depending on the uses, depending on the time frame, depending on also even like your risk aversion and stuff like that. But our goal is to finance the project. And certainly we see many founders, for example, that are super technical, that are like the best in the world at their AI thing in whatever sector. But obviously they are not the guys that know a lot about how to finance a project and they haven't done it in the past. And yeah, like it would be very surprising if they knew it. So the good founders, in my opinion, ask for help and they know what they don't know. And I do have a marketing agency in my company because I have zero idea of marketing. We do have a fractional HR guy with us because I don't need a full time and he knows 1,000 times more than we do. So on this, it does make a lot of sense. Like you need to finance the project and you need someone with experience.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I think this is a good example. I feel like sometimes people task their fractional CFO in an incorrect way, you know, like they say, okay, it's about, let's get our management reports, let's do some cash flow projections or whatever. But really, you can ask your fractional CFO, listen, you know, you could bring it down to, you know what, I want to upgrade my house next year and I want to have the extra cash for it, which means this business needs to pay me whatever, which means go figure it out. And that's what a CFO can do for you. And if you're meeting commercial and sometimes personal objectives, that's what is possible, you know, but people don't realize that. They think, oh, it's the admin, it's overhead, it's, you know, it's taxes, it's whatever. And they don't understand the power of finding the correct person. Literally, it could be a life-changing difference to them if they find the right partner.
Even in that compliance part, I always say that we are like the goalkeeper. Like we're not going to win the game. Like a startup with a terrible product that like the accounting is crystal clear is not going to go anywhere. So even on that part, we aren't like, you prefer a good one over a bad one because it's the goalkeeper. Like if they screw up, they may bring down the project. But then there's also like an offensive part. Like, okay, what do we need to achieve? And you need the means. So you may need the money, you may need the strategy. You want someone that not only speaks about money in dollars, in euros, in whatever, but talks about KPIs, about client retention. Like you want a CFO that says like, why are we investing so much in inbound if outbound works much better? You want a CFO that says, let's stop hiring salesmen if the problem that we have is in the last cohorts, we see like way less retention than in the previous ones. So certainly can be also like an offensive role in that sense.
All right. So who is your chef's kiss perfect customer that you love working with?
Okay. SaaS company that just raised units of millions of euros. Let's say 3-4 million euros, whatever, that just got like maybe their second professional VC round and has an ambitious project ahead. Usually like we have exceptions, but like the perfect customer, as you were saying, is venture capital backed and they have a management team that they still lack the finance part because again, they still don't need it full time, but they realize that they need someone in charge.
Okay. So people can reach you at tscfo.com. That's Tango Sierra, the startup, cfo.com, and reach out. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just going to put you on the spot here. What value can you offer to listeners of the Gross Profit podcast if they reach out to you? What can you give them that they can't get anywhere else? I don't want to hear you on other podcasts giving this away, right? I don't want to see this in a promo. I want this just for us guys. So what can you do?
No, I mean, I always say that, like, when I make a sales pitch, it's not I'm making a sales pitch. I truly believe it. Like I hope I believe in my company and that we can add value. So I hope it's honest. So certainly, I think many people are working blindly on the numbers part. Maybe it has worked in the past, but, like, again, like, they may be having, like, a huge risk over there or, like, many companies don't know if they're going to run out of cash in 2 years and then you ask them 1 month later and they say in 4 months. It's like... like, don't try to be an expert on everything. You know about your technology. You know about your product, you know. And on that, I'm sure you're the best. But this part, you need someone that has done it before and you know that will save you the risk and that can contribute to you on the strategic part as well. In fact, by the way, in many corporates, the CFO is the successor of the former CEO. So it should be someone completely strategic that sees the whole company and can add a lot of value. It's not just the bean counter. Like, then they wouldn't be the new CEO. So this, a good CFO is a guy that is the right hand to the CEO and can add a lot of value on the strategy too.
Very good. Okay. Tough negotiator. You didn't give anything up there, but that's fine. You want this guy on your side. You don't want him giving stuff away for free. So, all right. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you for getting this far into the podcast. Your special reward, even if Jaime is not going to give you anything, I'm going to give you something. You are now able to go to procurementexpress.com/CFO mastermind. What is it? So we had one last night. They're really good. We get fractional CFOs together. We had about 30 last night. We get them together. You get put into a room with 3 or 4 other fractional CFOs. and you get to bring a business problem. So it could be practice development problem, it could be a client problem. You have 1 minute, you get basically 4 minutes to outline your issue, and then you get feedbacks from your peers. Sometimes those peers are a few steps ahead of you, sometimes they're a few steps behind, but you get to brainstorm the business problems that you're facing in your practice. I really recommend it. It's a lot of fun. We get very good reviews on it. So you can sign up at procurementexpress.com/CFO Mastermind. Thank you very much. Thanks, Jaime. This has been fun.
Thanks to you. Likewise.